Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to How Should I Be Positioned on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. On this podcast, we do like to catch up with our industry colleagues and partners to discuss the market and macro environment, along with thinking when it comes to asset allocation. Joining me here today for the conversation from the UBS Chief Investment Office, here in studio with me, glad to have back Jason Draho, Head of Asset Allocation for the Americas with UBS CIO. We're also excited to be joined today from Vanguard by Joe Davis. Joe is Vanguard's Global Chief Economist and Global Head of the Investment Strategy Group. This marks Joe's first appearance with us here on How Should I Be Positioned? So plenty to discuss today, though to begin, Joe and Jason, thank you both for dropping by and for spending some time with our listeners today. It's great to be with you both.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having me.
Joe, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you. Excited.
So where to begin? As I mentioned, there is a lot going on in the markets at the moment, though it may be helpful, Joe, if we start by hearing your outlook thoughts on the U.S. economy, seeing as how we're roughly through the first quarter of 2025. How would you characterize the health of the U.S. economy as it stands today? And what is your outlook for the economy's trajectory throughout the balance of 2025?
I think even starting the year, the U.S. economy had considerable momentum. I mean, the U.S. economy was growing roughly 3%, you know, above what some would call trend, and the labor market was still adding jobs at a plentiful pace, and inflation was sticky, but not alarmingly high. We were anticipating a slowdown in part because of tariff implementation that would have taken some of the air out of the economy, closer to 2%. I think, you know, since the beginning of the year, growth has been weaker. I wouldn't say alarmingly so. I know there are some in the market that are looking at some alarming statistics in January, but I think there's some distortions in the data. So I'd say the bottom line is the U.S. economy is clearly downshifting. Uncertainty has clearly risen from a policy uncertainty perspective, but not to the extent that we're seeing a pullback that I would say would raise recession risk. So it's a slowdown that does bear watching, but nevertheless, we're still constructive on the economy.
Joe, I think I would agree with a lot of what you're saying in terms of our economic outlook. Look, the economy had good momentum coming into the start of the year, so we would have said something like, you know, 2.5-ish% GDP growth, a little bit of moderation. Given what the data we're seeing and given some of the policies, I think that's going to be a little bit lower than that. But I would agree, like, in terms of these concerns about recession, it feels a little, we've jumped from like strong momentum to suddenly recession fears that we've, you know, hadn't had even the slowdown kind of to for investors to digest. And the data we're getting of actual economic activity is not consistent with a significant slowdown. The sentiment is really what's kind of weakened the most. Right? I think people are much more cautious, but I'd also point out a couple of years ago, sentiment was deterred at some point, yet people were still spending. So I think there's always, like, you know, I look at what people are doing, not what they're saying. I think that's a better indication. But I wanted to pick up on one thing you mentioned, like, Joe, that you had assumed some sort of, I guess, tariffs in your baseline forecast. What exactly sort of where we are right now? You know, we're not at April 2nd, but like that's when sort of tariffs are supposed to be announced, these reciprocal tariffs. What are you assuming? And maybe how sensitive is your outlook to this? Like, you know, is it skewed a lot to the downside? How much do you think the economy can actually absorb if under different tariff scenarios?
So we went into the year assuming 30% tariff rates on China. That's generally tracked to where we are today. Roughly 5% for the rest of the world. Now, that's tough to, you know, sort of put your head around because we're talking about potentially much higher, 25% in Canada, Mexico, some discussions around Europe. You know, let's say we get somewhat higher than that, particularly outside of China. The U.S. can take it unless you're talking about everything that's been announced. And then perhaps a little bit more. So 25% Canada and Mexico across the board would be fairly disruptive just for how integrated global supply chains are. That would take U.S. GDP growth down to roughly 1% this year. Now, that doesn't sound negative, hence not recessionary, but that's the level by which you're starting to see flatlining in the labor market and the Fed that was would probably be easing in more of an emergency measure. So I would say it is sensitive, Jason, to the baseline, but you have to really push these tariffs. Again, I think we also, investors, have to separate what sometimes is announced versus what can operationally be implemented. I think Canada and Mexico, at least on some of the auto sectors, can be very tough operationally to do.
Well, I would test a little bit of a theory with you that I have, and like I'm not sure if I fully believe this myself, but We go back 2 years ago, like in early 2023, the consensus view in the market was that the U.S. economy would have a recession. You know, the Fed is hiking rates, inflation is too high. The only way it's going to happen is you get a recession, which turned out to be like the wrong call. But not only that, but back in 2023, you know, especially in like the third and fourth quarter, the economy was growing like at almost like 4%. So it was accelerating, the exact opposite of what people assumed. And once the sort of the dust settled and people kind of like fully embraced, like, well, we're not going to get a recession near term, there was a little bit of ex post, you know, Monday morning quarterback of like, well, you know, why didn't we get a recession? We can kind of point to different reasons, but it's one thing that I kind of think of, but I can't really quantify exactly, is that, you know, that the U.S. economy is dynamic. I would say over the past, you know, 10, 20 years, like it's sort of, there's been an uberfication of it, meaning the ability of the economy to adjust in kind of real time to prices shifting around, supply and demand and adjusting accordingly when prices rise. And we saw that back in 21, like when the supply chains were a problem, like you get supply ramping up and people trying to figure out the problems, demand shifts from goods to services and vice versa. Like it was almost to me like a real time proof of a concept that a free market sort of price system can actually do a pretty good job of reallocating resources. Now that's again, it's more of a conjecture than like something you can really, I think, prove. But I kind of use that as a backdrop to think, well, everyone is concerned about tariffs causing a significant slowdown, but because higher prices go up, supply chains are disrupted. But we just had this sort of almost natural experiment 3 years ago. It turned like the U.S. economy actually did well. And it's not just maybe fiscal stimulus because demand was good, yet prices came down. Do you buy into that? And Bill, please feel free to completely disagree, poke holes into it. But I kind of wonder if like there's a little maybe more concern about
it. I think it's a really good point. I mean, I think what this, and this is where, you know, at least our analysis of Vanguard, we stand in disagreement with the general narrative out there around the soft landing. And I only bring it up because it's relevant for today. And the assumption was, or at least the general narrative, to your point, Jason, was that, the Fed kind of, you know, kept rates restrictive and just pulled off exactly just enough cooling to keep growth up there and to bring inflation down. The fact is, as you said, growth went up and inflation generally came down. The only way you got that is through a major supply. So immigration plus some of the productivity lift explains roughly 80% in our calculus to the soft landing. In other words, if we didn't have those factors, we would have had a recession. Now, that's not being a Monday morning quarterback. I only bring that up because what's relevant for today, the productivity will probably hang in there a little bit for this year. So that's a positive for the U.S. economy. The immigration will slow markedly. In fact, it already has. And so that will not be a lift to the growth in the near term in 2025, much like it was the past 18 months. I mean, that was a significant. It closed roughly 80% of the labor market imbalances over an 18-month period, much more. So the immigration normalized the labor market, not the Fed. So that matters to bear. Now, with that, where you're getting in another shock here with tariffs. As you said, tariffs in of itself, although they grab a lot of headlines, they're not enough given trade is not a huge factor of the U.S. economy. That in of itself is not enough to take down the economy. You have to start introducing other policy uncertainty measures that would really spook businesses. And that's where we're seeing an uptick. So it bears watching, but trade alone can't do it unless you're talking about egregious tariff levels.
You mentioned productivity, and this is, I know you've written on this in terms of like mega trends. It's something that I've kind of focused a lot on, thinking about like a roaring 20s scenario and whether they would be able to continue to play out. Regardless of the policy, you need sort of productivity growth to kind of move forward. And, you know, everyone is sort of looking to AI as maybe the cure-all for that. I know, and again, you've done a lot of work. Your team has done a lot of work on this. Given sort of even sort of the more recent developments from, you know, DeepSeek and like, you know, kind of bringing down the cost curve for these models, this year, the last 2 years has been a story of like AI infrastructure. You build the kind of the models, the data centers, and now it's more about like applications. What is your thought in terms of like how AI and just productivity in general could sort of offset some of these other, you know, maybe policy headwinds? Is it too soon? Is this like a not like until like a 2028 or 2030? Like where, and maybe I'm looking for the glass half full, but like, how do you think about it at this point?
Sure. I technological change is always two phases. One is the build out, if it's meaningful, and that's multi-year. That's producing the technology. And then the back half in the so-called J curve is when we consume it. So it's non-tech companies consuming it. Think of the personal computer. The build out was, you know, early to mid and even some of the late 90s. The usage was beginning in the late 90s into the 2000s with the software. So in the AI, we've done a lot. We calculate our own data. We've modeled it across every other technology the past 150 years. it generally points to the fact that that AI has the likelihood of being more transformative or as transformative as the personal computer, which would lift economic growth roughly by the year 2030 because of productivity closer to that 3% level on a sustained basis. So that's very positive. The productivity boom is not upon us today. Where we're seeing productivity is really just in, as you said, the data centers, the production of AI, less so the consumption. And again, that's where the wild card would be, because if it's going to be as constructive as we think, we need to see adoption and continued AI growing capabilities over the next 3 to 5 years. This is not a one-year phenomenon. But at least the early indications are consistent with it being potentially transformative. You can point to two. One is the massive amount of investment going in. And then secondly, the number of new entrants or new companies that have been formed. So that doesn't guarantee that it's transformative. It just means it's consistent historically more with, you know, computers, electronics, and parts, electricity. But again, you know, how you then invest in it is a completely different question from the economic impact.
Picking up on this sort of transformative idea, but not on AI, but like on policy outside of the U.S., you know, the very strong consensus view at the end of last year, even early this year, was this U.S. exceptionalism story. And look at the data for the past 2 years, where the U.S. economy has grown much faster, say, than versus Europe, which is kind of flatlining around recession levels. It's emblematic of the equity market performance. It was viewed as all like the real innovation in AI was happening in the U.S. And now, barely 3 months into the year, you've had transformative policy changes in Germany, which I think would have been very hard to believe for people to believe, like a year ago. The developments of AI models in China, that's certainly changing sort of dynamic there. When you think about the global picture, do you think sort of this U.S. exceptionalism story it's run its course? Do you think this has legs in terms of what's happening in Europe? Like, how do you think of the global landscape today versus even like, say, 3 months ago?
We were skeptical that the U.S. exceptionalism would have a long shelf life. The U.S. market, despite all of its strengths, is just fighting the overvaluation any way you cut it. Even if you're very constructive on AI, and it's a lot of work that we've done. In other words, even if you think AI is as transformative as electricity, which is pretty much like the high watermark for technology impact on an economy, it was still very difficult to justify valuations because they earnings and multiples, because they would have to grow 40% annualized over a 3-year period, just almost physically impossible in the aggregate market level. So again, exceptionalism, you know, we had a lot of lucky factors last year, immigration from a huge positive labor supply shock and some of that AI build out that, you know, just other countries hadn't participated. So the momentum was considerable. But we were eventually going to see valuations start to leave an imprint. Now, for the record, I would have said that of U.S. versus non-U.S. markets, at least for the past 2 years. They're not a very helpful timing device, but they can give you a backdrop. And there was just a matter of time before the history of technology that's happened in every other incident would happen in AI. And that would be the number of new entrants start to erode the ROI of the incumbents, even though the technology has value. And so China DeepSeek, that's going to be the first of, I would guess, dozens of future announcements in the next 3 years. It means two things. It means the prices will come down, technology and adoption will go up, but it also means the ROI from an investment standpoint in those parts of the market will really start to unravel.
You know, one of the debates, maybe it's not as common now, but certainly like a year or two ago when DeepSeek was first, or not DeepSeek, but ChatGPT was first introduced, and people were like trying to digest, like, what would this mean for investing, for the economy? Like, I think in general, it's a productivity enhancing tool, so it's disinflationary for the economy. But for investing, there was kind of a question of like, who's going to get the benefits? Is this going to be a winner-take-all market? Are the dominant, you know, tech companies going to get all the revenue because they have the scale? Is it something where it's going to be a utility that is ultimately kind of, companies will have to pass on the cost savings, so it's not going to allow them to enhance kind of margins? So how do you think about AI, but sort of maybe that sort of technology kind of evolution in general? Is that, where do you think the winners will kind of shake out? And like, what is that better for U.S. mega cap? Is it better for the rest of the market? Is it better for the rest of the world ultimately, given those valuations?
Yeah, well, I think that's it's a wonderful question. I'll give you our perspective. And again, not all technologies impact the markets, as you said, the same way. It depends if there's a winner-take-all dynamics. It depends upon, the high fixed costs or not. And so if you have a moat around that business model. I think with AI, what our hypothesis is and what our research shows is that the vast majority of the gains should go outside of the technology sector from a productivity or relative earnings boost.
That's interesting. So yeah, it's a democratizing perhaps tool more so than a monopolistic tool. Just continuing on the kind of the return topic. So we recently at UBS and our chief investment office published updated capital market assumptions. Like, so return expectations for, you know, like let's say the next full business cycle, like 7 to 10 years. I know that you recently did an update. And I've seen the numbers. I'd say your numbers, at least for U.S. equities, are a little more conservative than ours. Like we are saying, from a compounded annualized return, like around 6%. Your numbers are more like kind of 3 to 5 if I'm looking at kind of equities overall. Is that, I guess, what would you say like the key drivers for those numbers? Do you think they are, is it like more like valuation? Is it sort of like earnings outlook? Is it tying to what you just said? Like it's going to be other markets will benefit. It's not going to be like the big mega cap companies that reap most of the rewards. And that's kind of driving some of those return assumptions.
Yeah, it's a really good question. We haven't had this projection of over the next, say, 7 years where the expected returns on U.S. stocks are below where the median is for, say, U.S. fixed income. So we're projecting roughly a 50% probability of a negative, equity risk premium or stocks outperform bonds, which sounds fairly pessimistic. It is almost exclusively to the valuations within the growth and mega cap areas, which are large enough to leave that sort of imprint. Obviously, if you break up the market, the signals aren't as reliable, but you can still get a pattern where you don't have that as negative for, say, the value part of the market because the valuations there aren't as extended. So, we do have earnings that boost. We have had for more than 3 years a higher neutral rate in the fixed income market. That's generally, I think, been accepted. But it's really so that's all positive for total net returns regardless of the asset class, but it really is the valuation space that we have to work through on the technology part of the market. Now we've had some recent correction. But I said it's not enough to be constructive on AI to even with that assessment, we still get these projections because of the overhang that we have on the valuation side. Again, I'm hope I'm wrong and we're a little bit on the pessimistic end, but that's where the math is coming from. And that's how we're getting, close to flat to bond market returns for a time.
You're going on the bond market returns, it's a little, I guess higher than U.S. equities overall. When I actually, something that's interesting, when I've looked at the 10-year treasury for the past, let's say a year and a half, if you just like plot it out on a chart and then you plot out like the market pricing for kind of a terminal Fed funds rate or the proxy for like a neutral Fed funds rate, it's like a five-year kind of, forward rate. The lines move in almost exact parallel, meaning like if you were to run a regression, it's like, 99% R squared fit between, if I told you what the Fed funds rate terminal rate would be, I can tell you what the tenure is. So in a lot of ways, like almost getting the forecast for the Fed right this year and going forward will tell me, well, that's based on the market price and where the tenure would go.
Yeah.
So anyway, like someone like asking about the Fed and your expectations for this year and maybe beyond, well, then tell me kind of implicitly a little bit what your kind of rate forecast is. And so what is, curious, like, given the economic environment you described, it seems a little more optimistic than maybe the chatter in the market right now. What do you think the Fed will do? Where do you think ultimately then, like how much they cut ultimately in the cycle? Like where is your estimate of sort of neutral? And then that, I guess, you kind of back out what is your, the kind of the views on rates and sort of driving the fixed income returns.
It's really good. I think, from the Fed, this is an institution that's very dovish. That's not meant as a criticism, just more as an assessment. And so I think we'll see some easing from them if we still have another leg down in GDP and growth, particularly the labor market. So when we have, one or two easings, priced in part because tariffs just do a little disruption to growth, not alarmingly so, but we take a little wind out of the sails. But you're right. I mean, we spend a lot, just as much time, not just what the Fed does this year as, where are they going to be 3 or 5 years from now? Because that does pin down the long end of the curve. It also helps for all the other risk premiums that you're assembling for client portfolios, stocks, and you name it. And again, we're really proud of the research. We started over 2.5 years ago. We published it externally, intentionally. We've shared it with Federal Reserve policymakers I'm up on a dozen calls with them. And the research was clear 2 years ago is that R-star, the neutral rate, was higher and had nothing to do with trend growth. It had to do with the growing what's called structural deficits in the U.S., which is a form of dissavings, and so pushes up the neutral rate to balance the markets a little bit higher than expected. And so that puts us, we back then we said it was around 3.5 to 4, and given the structural deficit today, the neutral rate is roughly 4, which means that's pretty much the lower bound for a 10-year treasury, unless you're really going into a crisis situation, because you have a little risk premium in the bond market. So, 4% is the neutral, and, I hope the CBO isn't right, but that's probably the biggest headwind the U.S. economy faces over the next 4 or 5 years, and that is the structural component of the fiscal deficit. Roughly 6% of GDP during peacetime is pretty extraordinary. So that is what's pushed up the neutral rate. That's why the Federal Reserve is not as neutral as they is. And I think we've seen the Fed raise their long-term dots, consistently. And again, our research 2 years ago said you need to raise your dots. If not, you run the risk of a policy error. I think they've risen, they've increased the dots, and they probably have a little bit more to do. So, that's our assessment. It's in the low 4% range today. And I'm just telling, this audience that what is tied to that is the structural deficit from the CBO and other agencies. And if that continues to rise, you're going to have the neutral rate and then hence the 10-year rise a little bit more in the next 3 or 4 years.
Just so I'm clear, when you're talking about like a 4% as a bit of a floor, is that for the 10-year? Or do you think like the Fed actually can't cut more than once or twice because the neutral Fed funds rate, the nominal neutral Fed funds rate is actually 4%?
No, I mean, I think you got to separate the neutral rate, which really helps the long end of the curve. You separate the neutral rate from where the Fed is doing an easing or tightening cycle, right? The 4% is kind of like the speed limit. But, if the U.S. economy weakens, you should drop below the speed limit. I mean, you got to hit, you really got to hit the brakes and provide a stimulus. Now, again, why it's important is because for 2 or 3 years, the Fed thought that they were very restrictive. And my only point is that you were not very restrictive. You were just restrictive. So it matters only for how far they go in the easing cycle should they feel compelled to ease. If the U.S. economy weakens, they're going to drop below neutral, whatever you and I and others think that rate is. But if it's 4 and the economy is growing at 1%, you're going to have to drop well below 4%. That doesn't change the neutral rate. That just says that now you're stimulative. And so you would get a very steepening of the curve. Probably the 10-year wouldn't rally nearly as much as the 2-year. And that's why if you're really bearish, you would want to be short duration rather than long. It gives you a barometer where that fair value and the intermediate long end of the curve will be, probably, point to point Fed cycle beginning to the end.
You mentioned that the kind of the primary driver of getting to this, like the 10-year, if I get the 4-ish and maybe a little bit higher range, yep. It's a structural story that's more deficit and fiscal oriented. Just bringing back the AI story, because you mentioned like it's not sort of potential growth. Suppose AI kind of is on your base case, maybe a little bit the upside in terms of how much it improves productivity growth. That raises trend growth. Like we can say right now, if it's 2%, maybe to 2.5, maybe even a little bit higher. Are you assuming that? Because if that's the case, that would sort of shift maybe where the Fed cuts, because if the economy can grow stronger at that rate, well, then you don't need to cut as much, in a normal yeah. environment. Like how much does that, in the AI potential growth aspect, productivity growth, influence your kind of thoughts on more the longer term view of rates?
This is the heart of what we've been spending a lot of time on. And again, this is tough stuff, but say over the next 5 years, I mean, ultimately in all these big trends we care about in the world, globalization and tariffs, the deficits, AI and technology, it really is going to come down to this horse. I call it a horse race or a tug of war between the lift potentially from AI on the one side and then the deficit spending and what that can do to borrowing costs on the other side. The nice thing is that we've quantified what those odds are given all the analytical work that we've done. And there's roughly a 2-to-1 odds in stacked in favor of AI. I wish those odds were higher. But that means that all else equal, we're going to get a greater lift to growth, less worry on inflation. But it's not a foregone conclusion. It's roughly a 60% chance that AI is transformative enough. It doesn't mean our debt issues go away, but it's closer to the late 90s if you want to use an analog. But we're early in the J curve for AI. If you're more bearish assessment of AI, there's roughly a 30% chance again, we've quantified it, simulating what all these conditions are across thousands of indicators. And then you get something where the borrowing AI is not transformative. You don't get the lift from technology. You get a demographic-driven headwind from deficits, and that's where the borrowing costs start exceeding 5% on the 10-year Treasury. So you can see where like that push and pull, the dynamic. I can tell you this, the odds of getting the consensus forecast from the Federal Reserve and the IMF and the CBO, which is roughly 2% growth and 2% inflation, is almost mathematically impossible given these push and pull dynamics. We're getting one or the other. We're not getting the mainstream, which then I think brings us into the interesting world of how can you hedge a portfolio that embraces those so-called tails if there's a low likelihood of being in the middle? And you know, that's really something we're working on now.
That's complicated. If it's not a normal distribution, if it's kind of like bimodal, like with two tails,
it's like bimodal.
Yeah.
You know, it's really tough to generate those things. Yeah. Like, this was unexpected to us.
Well,
this
congratulations on throwing me a curveball like that. I have to think about that a little bit more. And I wouldn't mind going back to the 90s. I think that's a pretty good economic time period. If we can sort of replicate that even on a more modest scale. I know we don't have too much time left, but I wanted to kind of think maybe bring it back more. Like, we're talking a lot of long term, even our assumptions, like equity returns, we'd agree, like, you know, going to be lower than they have been. But that sort of tells you over a 10-year time period, it doesn't mean that equities can be up still 10% or more this year. So what, you know, things, given sort of all this landscape, given this sort of maybe more longer term bimodal distribution of when the markets start to price in or not, how are you thinking about just broad sort of, you know, financial market performance this year? If you have tilts or preferences, you know, do you think the outperformance of international markets could continue for equities, or that is, yeah, that's kind of played out and then US, you know, things will kind of rotate back? You know, what are maybe some general economic or investment themes that you have and high conviction right now?
Yeah, that's a key question. That's, you know, and I read a lot of UBS's work and some really great points there. I'd say it points us in three directions. So whatever one's policy portfolio is on listening to the podcast, you know, let's say it's 60-40, just for sake of argument, 60% stocks, 40% fixed income. It points you into three areas. One is at the margin from a risk management perspective is you downweight equities a little bit, but you have to know that you're giving up a little risk premium in the long run. That's solely because of the U.S. The two more higher conviction ones, though, are overweighting the value part of the market. It effectively says overweight or underweight U.S. technology at the expense of everything else. And I'm not picking on U.S. technology as I have an axe to grind. I'm just talking about the valuation and how technological change works. So it would point you to the value parts of the market. It would point you a little bit to overseas, which, again, has dramatically underperformed, as you noted, for the last several years. But that's where our analytics point to us. That actually hedges most of that so-called bimodal risk, even if we go down the downside, because you're not less exposed to tech. But I know that's kind of opposite of where some of the momentum is in the market, meaning the interest from investors. That's where it points us for the next 5 years. Then, of course, you can introduce active managed strategies within those portfolios. There, you're just looking for investors who can predict or find the needles in the haystacks. And they don't always come in the technology sphere, but they could. And so that's always a consideration, almost regardless of where valuations are.
Well, in terms of international markets, you know, I would note that at the beginning of the year, one of the most common questions I was getting from our advisors was something along the lines of, like, should we just buy the S&P and give up on international markets overall, given the performance of the last 2 years? And it was the most kind of concentrated number of questions like that I've gotten in a while, which in hindsight, that's probably, you know, a good counter indicator. And now the questions I'm getting is, like, well, how much international should we buy? And I think from a tactical perspective, like the run that you've seen, say, in German equities versus U.S., like over the last 3 months, this is not going to be sustained. It could sort of reverse. So from a tactical perspective, I think we sort of still lean more towards the U.S. somehow, just given what's happened the past 3 months. But on a multi-year view, I think that I always would sort of point to, like, a lot of our kind of investors. Well, I think investors globally have been over-allocated to the U.S. because of this U.S. exceptionalism story. U.S. investors in particular have a real home bias. So I think it's more along the lines of, like, there's a bit of a reset globally that's kind of going on, and it's worthwhile, like, thinking about, are you properly allocated globally? I think so. It's more of a strategic conversation.
I would just say I would strongly recommend investors at least be within the 20 to 40% zone outside of the U.S. To go below that, I'd put it this way. To go below that is really making a very, you know, very strong conviction that you think all the technological change we're going to have for the next 10 years or 5 years is going to be led out of the U.S. And for those that, you know, really have a reluctance outside the U.S., I'm always reminded of the lesson I learned from Japan in the 1980s, where they were the technological leader. Many questioned why you would invest anywhere outside of Japan. And, of course, I am not saying the U.S. is the next Japan. What I'm saying is a reminder that you effectively, to have a U.S. exposure is a really strong stance, not only on technology where it's going, but it's going to be highly concentrated. And if you look at where AI is going, it's unlikely that's going to be confined in those borders. So I think that could be a useful guide in the next several years, where we're fairly constructive outside the U.S. on the stock market.
Well, with that, Joe and Jason, thank you both very much for spending some time with our listeners and our clients here on How Should I Be Positioned? We did cover a lot of timely ground for our listeners, and as macro and market conditions continue to evolve throughout the year, Joe, it would be great to have you back at some point to continue the conversation, though. Joe, Jason, thank you again for your time today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. This is a great conversation. A lot of things that we can pick up on a future conversation.
I would love to.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
UBS Chief Investment Office's investment views are prepared and published by the Global Wealth Management business of UBS AG or its affiliates. The views and opinions expressed in this material by external guest speakers are those of the author, speaker, and are not those of UBS, its subsidiaries, or affiliates. Accordingly, UBS does not accept any liability over the content of this material or any claims, losses, or damages arising from the use or reliance of all or any part thereof. This material has no regard to the specific investment objectives, financial situation, or particular needs of any specific recipient, and is published for informational purposes only. For a full legal disclaimer applicable to the independent investment views produced by UBS, please visit our website at ubs.com/CIO-disclaimer.